If it please the court, I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal if it is needed.
Fine.
Your Honors, I am David Fasciello on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Perkins. My colleague below is at the table with the appellant, and he was the lawyer that argued the case with me at trial. I will be making the actual argument. This is an interesting case because it raises several unusual issues. Factually, what transpired is essentially as follows. My client was met by his former girlfriend, Anya, on the evening of the crime. She came in. She was originally going to discuss Christmas options because they had a child in common. At some point, my client and she made love. At some point, she became sick. My client made light of it and cleaned up vomit. My client indicated in his testimony that he and she then showered together. And indeed, the investigating officer did report at trial that there was water beading in the shower, indicating recent use. My client got involved in the altercation with Anya when he was apparently stepping out of the shower ahead of her and dressing because he was going to possibly be meeting another paramour. A phone call rang, according to my client. She saw the caller ID. It was the name of a woman that she did not like, she feared had been in a relationship with my client. My client indicated at trial that Anya pulled a gun on him. He indicated that when she did, they ended up in a very serious scuffle. She threatened to kill him, and the neighbors heard most of the scuffle, though they did not hear the words that were exchanged. My client says at trial and stated before the jury that he actually pulled Anya, trying to get the gun that she had been pointing at him, from the living room to the kitchen, and that they ultimately slid outside the back door onto the porch area and the steps. Thinking that Anya was pulling away from him, he finally did dislodge the gun from her. And when he dislodged the gun from her, she was running down ahead of him, trying to brake himself so that he would not be running after her at this point. He slipped, the gun dislodged, and Anya was fatally shot. At trial, the medical examiner testified that there were indications that the downward trajectory was the cause of death of the bullet wound. The medical examiner also testified that there were indications that there may have been a scuffle, and there were indications that there had to have been the shooting within some short area. The medical examiner said that most likely he thought that the gunshot may have occurred from the middle part of the staircase to the bottom where she lay, but conceded that it is possible that it may have been from the upper portion to where my client claimed that he had actually dislodged the gun.
That testimony was without objection.
That testimony was not objected to at that point. You're correct, Your Honor. At the time of his testimony, he also indicated that that there may have been gun residue because he was aware of another report by Elisabetta Bakalska that might also support the fact that this may have occurred in a short period of distance. My client then did something incredibly terrible and foolish. He left the scene with the gun. He was in shock. He later disposed of the gun when he met a friend who, with her friend, Miss Acacio, took him to a place where he hid until he could eventually turn himself in, but unfortunately he was apprehended before he turned himself in. The record reflects that he made numerous contacts with Mr. Modica, his attorney, to accomplish that. At trial, counsel raised a couple of issues that are very important, one of which, though, was at the motion for judgment of acquittal, the fundamental final questioning of the expert, who was the medical examiner, the assistant medical examiner, was asked in terms of reasonable medical probability. At the motion for judgment of acquittal, counsel raised the issue that the standard in the case of a medical examiner must be reasonable medical certainty. Counsel pointed out 29 Delaware Code 4707, a law, even though it predates the Dutton decision, that was established in June 14th of 1969, that created for the medical examiner alone of all experts the reasonable medical certainty test. Interestingly, if this testimony was admitted in a way that met medical certainty, the state would have been able to proceed on murder first degree. But absent medical certainty, they did not meet the element of proof that would be necessary to meet the elements of the crime. And were that the case, we would have been able to proceed at best on murder second or manslaughter solely if the court believed or gave full credit to Ms. Acacio's testimony that my client in the car said that he had shot the victim and that they had had an argument.
Okay, so the first issue is whether, in the case of medical examiner testimony, the standard is reasonable medical certainty or reasonable medical probability.
That is exactly where we are, Your Honor.
All right. What is the other issue, if any?
With regard to that, that is the entirety, the concern of whether or not we follow just the common law with regard to how he testifies or the statute. The other issues, though, that are of import to counsel include the remarks of the prosecutor at trial. These, unfortunately, in part, are a plain error analysis because they were raised in post-trial briefing. But during trial and during the remarks, there were a couple of instances where the court did not grant a curative that were fundamentally important. In the closing remarks, counsel was called to the bench because the judge was trying to be preemptive and trying to protect the record of what had been a remarkably cordial trial in terms of all of the exhibits being agreed upon in advance. She was concerned with a reference by the prosecutor to a gunshot that we felt had occurred, a first gunshot separate from the fatal one, as being referred to as junk. Counsel did not object to that because it was basically a third-person observation and the jury could conjecture on it. Counsel did indicate to the court that it had concern with the fact that they had indicated twice in their comments that Ms. Acacia's testimony was unrebutted. It indeed was rebutted by my client, by Mr. Perkins. And the court indicated in its own record that it understood that, but never granted a curative or went any further than that. During trial, there were at least two sets of questions where it seemed like the state was questioning in a way that would have shifted the burden to the defense, and the court granted a curative the first time. It did not grant a curative the second.
I'm sorry, could you articulate the precise issue that you were asking us to decide in this respect?
Your Honor, we believe that when the prosecutor, in his closing remarks, said, no, he was not in love that night, in reference to my client, that he had had sex that night, and that something went bad, Anyea, the state suggests, wasn't smiling and bringing him on that night. He made her sick, she threw up, and somehow when she did that, he was enraged. Invites an unbelievable amount of speculation. There is nothing on that record that indicates that her throwing up had anything to do with the argument that transpired. There is nothing on that record that indicates that at any point my client was enraged with her other than by her pulling a gun. Prior to trial, it was indicated by counsel to the court when it was trying to delineate what the issues would be, that there was never a claim that there had been any kind of untoward, improper sexual intercourse. Counsel for the defense actually requested the DNA swabs of the vagina because we knew that he had had consensual intercourse with her that night. By inviting the jury to speculate on things that are not in the record, that could even raise the possible specter of rape or sexual assault or any other type of mean-spirited factors that are not involved in the actual facts, goes far beyond, in our opinion, reasonable argument by a prosecutor.
That there is no objection.
The objection, unfortunately, was not raised at that time, and you have to look at it in plain error unless you look at it in light of the other objection that was made with regard to the Acacio statements and the two objections that were made in trial. In our opinion, although this had been a remarkably civil trial, the prosecutor crossed the line in his argument. And he crossed the line in an area of speculation that he had committed himself not to cross the line into. The third issue that we wanted to address for your honors as a primary concern to counsel, and of course if the court wants to address the others issue, we certainly will, is the question of the jury instructions. In this case, we had requested for murder first degree and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony, both accident and justification. The court gave us justification as to the possession of a firearm by a person prohibited on the theory that maybe he got the gun during the struggle and therefore it was fair game. But the issue here is when my client said Anya pulled the gun out on him and threatened to kill him, and the language that she used was very explicit, he was in fear for his life. He himself indicated in cross-examination when asked, did she have the gun pointed to you? Yes, she could have shot it at me. I just reacted. I didn't go say, okay, let me go fight for my life. I reacted. I tried to smack the gun from her hand. Afterwards, when he left with the gun, he says, you know, I grabbed this gun. I just fought for my life for this gun. I wasn't letting this gun go. I don't believe I still had the gun when I already was in the car. He was justified in disarming the alleged victim, Anya. Not only was he justified in that, but the disarming was a process. We had indicated that we wanted a jury instruction on both justification and accident because the two concepts come so close together. Because the process of disarming means that a person has to have some knowledge of the attendant circumstances, the very definition of intent, which justification goes to. And one of the attendant circumstances of the manner in which my client disarmed Anya was that there is always the risk that something could go awry with a gun going off in struggle.
But that's not what he testified happened, is it?
If you look to his testimony, when he is questioned after the main part of his questioning by Ms. Medford, he is asked about what was going on in his mind. And he did say, I just fought for my life for this gun. I wasn't letting this gun go.
No. Let me interrupt. I'm not talking about when he was struggling to get the gun out of her hands. I'm talking about when they're going down the back steps and the gun goes off.
He did not realize.
Didn't he testify that that was an accident? That, you know, he's running down the stairs. He wasn't trying to shoot her. The gun went off by accident.
Accident clearly was a major part of it. But we submit.
But at that point,
yes,
you know, is it your position that notwithstanding that testimony, he's entitled to an instruction that the killing was justification?
The justification that he had clearly the right to an instruction was the entire process of disarming, including the attendant circumstance, which was the unfortunate firing of it in the process. He slipped because he saw Anya was down below, and he did not want to be chasing after her at that point.
But there's no evidence that he was in the process of getting the gun from her at the time that he killed her.
He had just grabbed the gun and was steadying himself at that moment. It is so close in time and so close in proximity. And because the whole process for which he is justified, which is disarming this person, he should have been allowed the instruction so that the jury could discern that he was justifying his acts for both the murder and the possession of the deadly weapon during the commission of a felony. By parsing it so closely and analyzing it in such a rigid fashion, the jury was deprived of the ability to understand that accident and justification for the very attendant circumstances were intertwined. And the definition of intent that speaks of attendant circumstances, we believe in and of itself, along with the two sections I quoted from the record, that there was a basis, a strong basis for the justification instruction.
But your client testified that he was running and went to catch himself, and that's when he hit the gun, like on the wall, and the gun went off.
Remember, Your Honor, this is all in seconds. And remember that as that happens, he also said he realized that Anya was not running to the house but running down the steps, and he braced himself to stop. All of this was within the very act of separating himself from her, sliding away down the step, and slipping.
So But that description that your client gave is all about accident. It's not about justification.
It's justification to disarm her, knowing the attendant circumstances thereof. And if the jury is not allowed to contemplate the fact that he was justified with regard to the possession of that gun, which is the other charge, possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony, then the jury is precluded from doing anything but finding him guilty. And that's not where the justification defense lies. It is important. It is fundamental. And in this case, the discernment of what transpired has to be regarded as a flow of actions. He was justified in everything he did to disarm her, including what became the accident. It is not just semantics, I submit. Your Honor, in looking at the purpose of the jury instruction, I would urge you to look at the definition of intent that involves the attendant circumstances, because it is an important part of what was going on, even in the split-second functioning of my client's mind at the time in which these events transpired. In looking at these three issues, we believe that the court needs to fashion an order of remand. We believe that the first issue that we first talked about, the issue relating to the medical examiner and his testimony, because it occurred prior to Dutton, the statute, and because this Dutton court never even reached the issue of looking at the statute from a review of the briefs in Dutton and the case law, that the court in Dutton had one expert, the anthropologist, Dr. Angel from the Smithsonian Institution, testify, according to Ms. Mullen's questioning, with medical or scientific certainty, that Dutton is distinguishable. And we also suggest to the court that because this is the first time you've been asked to regard the import of that statute and why it may have been enacted by the legislature, that the court must create a reasonable requirement, an absolute requirement, that medical certainty be the testimony of an expert. With regard to the remarks of counsel,
whether or not it's the medical examiner?
The medical examiner is the one, and assistant medical examiner.
That, but there's a different rule, at least as of now, with regard to a doctor who is not the medical examiner, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you asking that rule be changed?
We're asking that the statutory rule apply to the medical examiner and the assistant medical examiner that's referred to in the statute.
Right. So if the state had a particularly close or difficult case, they could hire a private physician to do the examination and he could testify at a lesser standard than the medical examiner?
There would, of course, be questions as to whether or not his expertise would go into the realm of autopsy and determinations. There might be a Dalbert issue, but yes. In Dutton, we had the anthropologist testify with scientific certainty. And had this issue been raised at that point, the court would have been raised facing quite an issue similar to this, but the court would have at least had something by which the testimony could have been buttressed. In this case, it was not.
You're into your rebuttal time if you want to save the rest of it.
I will save the rest of it if it's okay with Your Honors. Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. Good afternoon, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. For the record, Kevin M. Carroll, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state in this matter. When Dr. Kaplan testified to a reasonable degree of medical probability in the case at hand, he did so after explaining the basis for his opinion. He testified as to the autopsy, testified about the entrance wound suffered by Ms. Hawkins, testified about the exit wound. He also testified about the bullet's trajectory going through Ms. Hawkins' brain. And when he did so, he rendered his opinion consistent with this court's pronouncements in Dutton v. State as well as Florey v. State. Arguments to the contrary that because his testimony was to a reasonable degree of medical probability instead of certainty don't eliminate the fact that Dutton as well as Florey dictate the result here. Accordingly, Dr. Kaplan's testimony was simply sufficient as a matter of law. Furthermore, if this court were to be convinced to apply 29 Delaware Code Section 4707 to the facts at hand, then the plain terms of 4707 must be applied. And as the court will notice, nowhere in Section 4707 is the term in-court testimony referring to an assistant medical examiner or chief medical examiner incorporated into the statute. Accordingly, by its own terms, Section 4707 does not apply to in-court testimony of an expert such as Dr. Kaplan. Turning to the second issue, pertaining to the allegedly improper argument made by the prosecutor during closing, the court recognizes that this was not objected to. It is therefore a question of plain error for this court. Moreover, it's a question of whether or not the prosecutor's statement that something went bad is a legitimate inference to be drawn from the evidence presented. Clearly, under the facts and circumstances introduced at trial, something went bad is a legitimate inference. Moreover, defense counsel here asked this court to infer the worst-case possible scenario that the prosecutor intended this to mean some type of uncharged, unindicted, unmentioned, non-consensual sexual encounter between the victim and Mr. Perkins. In light of this court's opinion, there clearly is no basis for it. The fact that something went bad, it is ambiguous at best and accordingly should not be viewed in the worst possible light. Turning to the third issue, the question of jury instructions, the standard here must be emphasized. The defendant is entitled to a correct statement of law. He is not entitled to one that is confusing or misleading. Moreover, when asserting some type of defense here, there must be some credible evidence, and the trial court must find some credible evidence to support a justification instruction. Unfortunately, the Superior Court did not find any such credible evidence whatsoever with respect to counts 1 and 2 of the indictment.
Well, Mr. Fasciolo suggests that all of this was intertwined and therefore justification applied to everything. What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem with that, Justice Ridgely, is the fact that this wasn't just one entwined event. Here we have several steps along the way. The defendant testified that the victim, Ms. Hawkins, allegedly pulled a gun. Then there was a struggle. During the course of that struggle, they're crashing around. That's testified, that's corroborated by testimony concerning the heavy noises, movement, arguing from neighbors below. After the struggle, somewhere along the line, Mr. Perkins grabs control of the gun. Ms. Hawkins runs. She's gone. In fact, Mr. Perkins testifies that he loses sight of Ms. Hawkins. After he loses sight of her and with control of the gun, he decides that he's going to leave. Goes out the back door, and you know, that's when he has this accident where he slips and the gun goes off.
Well, you're making it sound as if a couple of minutes went by between the moment when he obtained possession of the gun and when it discharged. But I gather that the interval of time was more like a couple of seconds.
I would imagine that would be the case, Your Honor. But the fact of the matter is there are discrete steps that ultimately led to Ms. Hawkins being shot. And moreover, under Section 303, there is no credible evidence supporting a justification instruction here because, as this court has noted, there is no. Mr. Perkins testified that he has no idea how the gun went off. It was an accident. And in order to gain a justification instruction, excuse me if I just may have a moment here, the defendant has to believe that such force is immediately necessary for the purpose of protecting the defendant against the use of unlawful force. His claim that this was an accident, he had no idea how the gun went off, by rational extrapolation, eliminates this possibility to claim that I pulled the trigger, the gun went off, and I was justified in doing so. It's inconsistent, and as a matter, would have been misleading to the fact finder for them to have been instructed on this. Moreover, the Superior Court's on the record is indicating that there is no credible evidence whatsoever supporting a justification instruction with respect to the first two counts of the indictment. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them now. Otherwise, state rests on its briefs.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court. The issue with regard to the prosecutor's remarks are not just his reference to something went bad. The language that the prosecutor used that was unbridled, just creation from whole cloth, was the following. He made her sick. She threw up. And somehow, when she did that, he was enraged. There is no basis in the evidence, none whatsoever, to support that speculation. It is not legitimate inference. We are allowed to infer, if we are jurors in this case solely, that there did occur an altercation and that somehow it led to a gun causing the death of Anya. As to the discussions other than what was testified to and the creation of the fact that my client somehow became enraged when she threw up, it contradicts the record. It is a fundamental problem, and in what was otherwise a very civil case, it destroys the ability for the prosecutor to have acted properly. With regard to the question of the jury instructions, we would urge the court to look to the test that you outlined in Gutierrez. If there is reason to believe that the jury would accept the defendant's proposed evidence, it should be given an instruction if it can support the self-defense or justification defense. Thank you.
Thank you. The court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.